STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my friends. Thank you for joining me here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host, with you every week or generally every week, except for when I'm on vacation or out of town for an extended period of time, like recently. The show live starts at 4 p.m. Los Angeles time on Tuesday nights, goes for at least 2 hours, occasionally three. And those are the hours that you can call in for our show and chat with me. So I'm looking forward to talking with those who are already in the queue, and we will do that shortly. My daughters and my wife and I have been watching, just now we're finishing up the Harry Potter series of films. We're watching them carefully, watching them as a family, and talking through some aspects of the movies. I personally have been really taken. I didn't read all the stories, just the first one, but I've been taken with the mastery of this craft that Rawlings has shown in development of this story. But I will tell you, the reason I'm bringing it up now is because of the, how could I say, maybe spiritual parallel is the best way that I could put it. I often will find helpful spiritual application or meaning for me, and this might be deconstruction, I don't know, because I don't suspect some of the things that I find this meaning in have that meaning intended by the author. Nevertheless, I'm able to find that in different places, and I'm encouraged by it. And I find here, as we're finishing out the series, and we're in the last two videos, the last two DVDs, which comprise which cover the last book, the Deathly Hallows book, which brings the whole franchise to a close. I don't know what that's going to look like because we haven't seen the end yet. But I will tell you what impressed me and got me thinking about my own convictions as a Christian and the role or the way I see the world or maybe ought to see the world as a follower of Christ in light of reality. That is, in light of the way things really are. Now, that isn't the way they always appear. You know, our visual eyes only give us part of the story. We walk by faith and not by sight. That is, we don't see with our physical sight many of the things that we know have the most significant impact on our lives. Ephesians 6 says that there is a battle that is going on that is not a battle between flesh and blood principally. Flesh and blood being that which we see, but rather spiritual forces in heavenly places that are battling it out, and the repercussions are felt in the physical realm. Those just looking at the physical realm are not seeing the whole picture, which is a whole lot of people that are convinced that there's nothing but the physical realm to see. And if that's the case, they're not looking further, and they're not seeing the most important part of reality. Which, by the way, I think is one of the things that Paul in Ephesians 6 is warning us regarding. Because in Ephesians 6, he says, to put on the full armor of God so that you can stand against the schemes of the devil. For our battle is not against flesh and blood, but rulers and principalities and powers and spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. He's saying there are schemes of the devil that we could be taken in by if we are not properly protected by spiritual armor. And I think one of those schemes is to convince people that that spiritual world does not exist. But of course, in the Harry Potter series, the universe is thick with spirituality in that sense. And so I like the backdrop because the world view, or at least one aspect of it, is robust in that it entails not just the physical world, but the non-physical world as well. By the way, there are lots of parallels, I think, thoughtful Christians can find between their Christian life and some of the themes there in the series. But I want to just focus in on this one thing that really grabbed me as we got into the final set of DVDs to cover the last book, The Deathly Hallows. And that is, the party's over. No more fun and games. In a certain sense, in the earlier books, there is a certain lightness about the craft of magic and the things that the kids growing up learning these things got to participate in. But now they realize that everything is serious as a heart attack. And everything is on the line, not just their lives, but the lives of many of their friends, and indeed the status of the world on the brink of being enslaved by the evil one, as they call him, or the evil lord, I think is the way they refer to him. And so consequently, with this reality square in their mind, even though much of the rest of the world doesn't even see it, they completely give themselves to the task of spending their lives trying to deal with this threat. They have put their hand to the plow. They are not turning back. And indeed, Hermione, one of the three main characters, along with Ron and the main character himself, Harry Potter, Hermione casts a spell in her own home that erases her memory from the minds of her parents. All the images on pictures that include her disappear. She is making a break, and she's making it easy on them, though it's hard on her because she remembers. She is moving on to participate in a quest. She is putting her hand to the plow, and she is not looking back, and she is burning her bridges behind her because this quest weighs greater than anything else that she could possibly imagine. And, of course, while you're watching the films, they're well enough made that you're caught up in this and you're feeling the gravity of the circumstance. And now I'm in the second DVD on that final book, which is the last DVD of the series. And I am feeling, as a viewer, the weight of the circumstances they find themselves in. They have got to find the Horcruxes that, if they destroy, will give them final destructive capability over the Dark Lord. What's his name? Can't remember what his name is. But they call him What's His Name all the time in the film because they don't want to utter his real name. In any event, they are given to this task because it's their only hope. They are given their lives to the most important thing. And everything hangs in the balance. And I got to thinking, what occurred to me is that, yes, I'm feeling the gravity of this watching the movie at the hands of the filmmakers and the storytellers. And yet at the same time, every single Christian, every follower of Jesus, I should put it that way, that is not everyone who self-identifies as a Christian, but those who are followers of Jesus, every single one of them are in an equal station dealing with things much more grave than it is characterized in the Deathly Hallows, in the quest or the task. Or if you want to switch to a different film or movie, or you could talk about The Lord of the Rings and Frodo and Samwise Gamgee seeking to destroy the Ring of Power. It's the same thing. They are fully and completely invested. While the world around them keeps going on, not aware of what's at stake, they're giving themselves completely to it. Yet for me as a Christian and for you as a follower of Jesus, we have a role in a drama that is much more grave than is characterized by either Rowling or Tolkien. Because this is reality, not fantasy, and this has eternal ramifications. Anyway, I just thought I'd pass that on to you. That in the film, I was taken with the fact that everyone was focused and fully committed and fully engaged in joining the battle. And how much more should we have the same attitude given the fact that the battle that we're involved in is real, has eternal consequences, and we play a critical part? I think that's the difference between followers of Jesus and mere Christians. and I mean mere Christians in a pejorative sense, that are people who just simply self-identify as Christians, but they are not followers. They're not participators. Their lives are not on the trajectory after the Spirit that Paul talks about in Romans. They are not ground in which the seed has taken root and flourished and reproduces 30, 60, 100-fold, to go back to the parable of the sowers. Incidentally, I'm reading John MacArthur's book on the parables right now, which was why that illustration came to mind, or that passage came to mind, and I'm finding it really, really helpful. So I'm not sure if it's out yet. I think I got a pre-release copy, but just thought I'd pass that on. One other thing I want to pass on is that I have just viewed, talking about DVDs, Alustra Media's most recent submission here called Living Waters, Intelligent Design in the Oceans of the Earth. Now, some of you might be familiar with their earlier offerings, Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mysteries of Life, Metamorphosis, Flight, not birds, Flight. There's a lot of birds in it, no question. But it's kind of interesting, and Derek here at Stand to Reason made this observation. When they started out Unlocking the Mystery of Life, this is a graphic visual characterization of the problems with life coming from non-life as by an undirected process. And so there's the birth of the intelligent design movement, et cetera, that they characterize there, and it's a foil for developing these ideas, and it's very powerful to help you to see the inadequacy of naturalistic processes to do the things that materialists claim they do, and evolutionists in general. But in the last few, particularly Flight and Metamorphosis, which is about butterflies, and now Living Waters, it's almost like a nature film. Really well done. Excellent photography, well scripted, where you're just looking at the details of nature, and those details themselves become the most powerful argument for the necessity of a creator. And the narrators just loosely connect the dots. It's not a hard, heavy-handed, hard sell thing. You will be absolutely amazed by what you see here in this Living Waters. We sell this, but I'm not mentioning this because we sell it. We sell it because it's great, and that's why I think you should see it. It's the kind of thing that you could show to friends and family members and your children to help them get a visual that is powerful, that just simply points to an intelligent designer. It's a common sense approach, and it's one of those things where you watch the details and you say, tell me there's no God. Now, I understand the rejoinder. Oh, just because we haven't figured it out yet doesn't mean we won't figure it out. What they mean is just because we haven't figured out how natural processes could accomplish such an unbelievable task doesn't mean we won't figure that out. Well, look, I understand that. Let's just call that the naturalism of the gaps, all right, because that's all it is. There is no good reason to believe that's the case. Like when people say God of the gaps, oh, wait a minute, we put God in that naturalistic gap because the evidence there is for design. There's a reason to believe it. There's no good reason based on the evidence to believe that nature can do this. It's got all the hallmarks of design. But there just seem to be some things that are so unbelievably convoluted that it's and intricate that it's not just hard to imagine how a natural process could accomplish it. It seems foolish to even suggest such a thing. For example, did you know that there are probably, and they list them here in Living Waters, 15 or more different organisms that actually have the ability to navigate based on the magnetic fields of the Earth? Okay, that's a lot. Okay, like dolphins, like snails, like monarchs, like wildebeest, like whales, and on and on and on the list goes. And these are kinds of creatures that are wildly disparate from each other on the evolutionary tree. They're not closely proximated there, you know, like They're just a little variation, so they're going to kind of inherit this same ability wherever it came from. And the question they ask is, how is it that blind processes of genetic mutation and natural selection can produce the very same sophisticated geolocation system in so many different species? It beggars the imagination. It's just unbelievable, which means there's no good reason to believe that. It has every single mark of design to the nth degree, and this particular kind of thing pops up over and over and over and over again all throughout the biological system, the animal kingdom. Just incredible. So I invite you to watch Lustre Media's most recent offering, Living Waters. You can get it at Stand to Reason. And also check out their others, too. I just love Metamorphosis and Birds. No, Flight. Birds is Hitchcock. All right. Let's take a quick break, and then we've got lots of callers online. I'm looking forward to talking to you on Stand to Reason.
Would you like to know the one unifying theme of the entire Bible? Greg Kokel reveals it to you in The Bible Fast Forward, his sweeping 8-lesson series on DVD. Greg demonstrates, from Genesis to Revelation, that the Bible represents one cohesive plan of salvation. This fascinating tour of Scripture shows you how the events, covenants, and promises of the Old Testament come to their perfect focus and fulfillment in Jesus Christ. This masterful survey of God's redemptive plan is available to you on DVD or on demand via HD streaming or download. It also includes a comprehensive 145-page study outline with questions for reflection or group discussion. To order the Bible Fast Forward, visit STR's online store at store.str.org or call 800-2-REASON today.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And I hope you make this program a regular diet. Some of you listening through the radio broadcast around the country, you're only getting an hour or two. When we have so much more to offer, sometimes a third hour. And in any event, if you're only getting 1 hour, you want to get the whole show. And so you can do that for free by podcasting. So that's what I would recommend. By the way, just to let you know, I am going to be this weekend, August 2nd, at South Valley Community Church in Gilroy. And this will be the end of my second decade doing summer events with them. Really thrilled to be going there once again. On the 5th and the 19th of August, I'll be at Praise Church in Beaumont, Texas. So I'll be making two separate trips out there to be part of that congregation. On the 13th through the 15th, I'll be at the Cross-Examine Instructors Academy in Charlotte with Frank Turek and the crowd. And then on the 16th of August, I'll be at Hawthorne Gospel Church in Hawthorne, New Jersey. Very seldom do I get to Jersey. So that's the lineup here for the month of August. If you'd like the details on that, you can go to our website, str.org/training/events. You'll not only find my schedule there, but also Brett and Alan and Tim's on the same page. And if you're up in Canada and listening to the podcast, of course, Tim's out of Ontario, Canada, and works a lot in that area. You might be able to attend one of his fine events. Okay, let's go to Waco, Texas. This would be Chuck. Hey, Chuck, welcome.
Hi, Greg.
Hi there.
My wife and I first met you on the Alaska cruise. I think it was 2008.
Oh, okay. Was that our first cruise, I wonder? Our very
I think
first
it
one?
Might have been.
Huh.
But we knew nothing about Stand to Reason at that point, and we fell in love with you guys, and
have
been supporting you ever since.
Now, how did that? Yeah, it turns out that was our second cruise. Now, how is it that you ended up on our cruise without knowing anything about Stand to Reason? Were you just...
Well, we had been tied into Biola, some of the intelligent design stuff through Biola University.
Uh-huh.
And I'd actually gone out there once to attend a little conference of some people there.
Uh-huh.
And my wife was talking about where to go vacationing, and she said the Caribbean. And I said, well, that's awful hot. Let's go to Alaska. She said, yeah, right. But about a week later, the email came through from Biola saying this cruise is going to happen. And we looked at it and went for it.
Dynamite. Well, good. Well, glad you're on board. How can I help you today, Chuck?
Well, at church on Sunday, the assistant pastor where I go to church had mentioned that between Isaiah chapter 39 and 40, there was a 150-year gap. And she just went on from there. But, of course, that statement brings into question the authorship of the book, or at least part of the book.
Sure does.
And I wanted to know what you thought of the scholarship behind that idea, and also whether you think that second-guessing the Bible like that is a deal-breaker for a church.
Well, it troubles me if you're going to a church where the pastor, is your pastor a woman?
Well, this happened to be the assistant pastor, yes.
Okay. As an assistant, that itself doesn't trouble me, but because I went to church that had a lot of women in part of the pastoral staff, though the head pastor was a man in that case. But what troubles me is kind of this flippant reference and then moving on without any explanation. Not only that, is it sounds like she was committed to that notion, which means Isaiah didn't write Isaiah. Someone else did, or at least somebody else wrote half of it. Because he wasn't that old. He didn't last for two centuries, you know, and
right.
Which he could write. And so then the question is, why is that done? Now, there is a line of scholarship that has been, it started late 19th century and was very popular through the 20th century and then has been largely discredited in principle as a means of scholarship, but it is still believed by many. In which the Old Testament is sliced and diced into all kinds of different pieces written by lots of different people and then patched together. This started when someone made the observation that I think is mistaken, that there are two separate creation accounts, one in Genesis 1 and the other one in Genesis 2. And then since different words were used for God in Genesis 1, then in Genesis 2, gee, this seemed to them to indicate that now you've got two different authors and this is all being patched together. Piecemeal by different people, not by the people who allegedly or classically are understood to have written the pieces. And so you've got all, you know, the Pentateuch is all patched together and Deuteronomy is all patched together. This is a classic higher critical approach to the text. The question needs to be asked, though, what are the reasons people are fully convinced that there is not a unified author for these pieces? And it generally starts with a low view of Scripture, and to which they then attach a linguistic tool that suggests that different language or different means of speaking or different vocabularies are necessarily used or probably used by different authors. And therefore, when we see God addressed as with one Hebrew word, that is one author. And then we see God addressed with a different Hebrew word, that must be a different author. And so it really, this gets insane because they're breaking these accounts up into little bitty chunks, all these little bitty pieces in some cases, in some extreme cases. And so you have no unified text at all. So I don't have time to go into the rationale why it's discredited, but it just seems fairly straightforward that you can't count on the assumption that because there's different vocabulary words used, that means there are different authors. Okay? Now, so there are arguments that can be offered, and I think, you know, Josh McDowell's More Evidence That Demands a Verdict, his second volume, addresses a number of these higher critical approaches. So if you want to get more detailed information, that would be the way to go. But for Christians, though, for Christian churches, it ought to matter what Jesus had to say about these things. And so one approach for people who are committed to the divinity of Christ and the soundness of the New Testament documents is to see how Jesus treated these. And now, I can't give you chapter and verse on this, but my recollection is that Jesus cited a number of passages that, say, for example, in Isaiah, which is frequently cited in the New Testament, not just by Jesus, but others. And as authoritative text and identifying as Isaiah in some cases. So the inspired writers of the New Testament identify this text as having been written by Isaiah, where Isaiah wrote, for example, or Isaiah said, or whatever. So again, I don't have chapter and verse in front of me, but this the view that Jesus and the apostles had about the text, the Old Testament text, and who was the author of it, ought to inform our point of view about this as Christians. I can understand that's not going to appeal, that kind of argument won't appeal to folks who don't share our views. But if you're a Christian, for goodness sake, that's what Jesus had to say about the authorship, or what he seemed to assume about the authorship, should matter in the discussion. So that's the best I could do on short notice.
Would you say a church that is okay with that is a problem, or is that not a deal breaker?
Well, boy, a huge red flag shot up for me when I heard that. Because that implies a commitment to a broader base of scholarship that undermines the authority of the Bible in quite a number of ways. Now, I don't know if you've heard anything more like this from this particular pastor or for others on your pastoral staff, but this is a huge problem. I'd want to figure out what the heck this means. And maybe this is just a stray point of view from this pastor and nobody else agrees with it, but then why is it that somebody in authority is teaching this kind of thing from the pulpit if the rest of the pastoral staff and the elders of the church do not abide by this view? I mean, I think this is a significant breach and that you ought to pursue this a little bit.
If they think
that she's right, what ramifications does this have for other doctrinal considerations? That's what I think. That's the question I would ask.
Okay, thanks.
All righty. All right.
Yeah, thanks. Great answer.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate your call, Chuck. Thank you. I'm trying to remember. I get lost in the different names of these kinds of critical approaches, you know, the type of higher criticism or the species of higher criticism that is characterized by this approach. But like I said, Josh McDowell's More Evidence covers them quite thoroughly. Let's see. Let's go to Portland and talk with Terry. Hello, Terry.
Hey, Greg. How's it going?
Oh, it's Portland, North Dakota. Okay.
Yes.
Just for clarification's sake. Nice to talk to you, Terry.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you for your ministry. And one of the ways it's benefited my family, about 6 months ago, you mentioned a book that one of your daughters was going through with her classical education called The Fallacy Detective.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, well, I went ahead and purchased that.
Uh-huh.
And we actually, I've got six kids, so the older five go through this with me, and they love it.
Wonderful.
They absolutely love learning that.
That's great. It's great for adults, too.
Oh, I bought it primarily for me, but it's benefit from it. Great.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I'm glad that helped.
Yeah, so I appreciate that. And that kind of leads into.
By the way, that same author wrote another book too that you might also find helpful.
The Thinking Toolbox.
Yeah, that's it. The Thinking Toolbox. There you go.
Yeah, I ordered that one too.
Okay,
that one's next.
Okay.
I recently had an opportunity to speak at a E3 Bible camp. I had a couple slots of speaking things open.
Good for you.
I had a chance to speak on homosexuality. This is about 2 weeks after the SCOTUS decision.
Mm-hmm.
And you know as well as I that the K-12 ages are really seem to be the battlefield for their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of, with Matthew Vine's 40 questions and things like that.
We responded to that last week. Yeah, it sounds like
yeah,
you listened
to it. Yeah, and that was really helpful. I listened to some of that, too. So I find that they're being taken in by a lot of arguments that really are not logical, rational, and things like that. So
more people need to read The Fallacy Detective, don't they?
Absolutely. In fact, my kids are kind of pointing out different things that mom and dad say. That, you know, that's a red herring, or that's an ad hominem, you know, that sort of thing.
There you go. Wow.
Which I encourage. It's great.
Uh-huh.
But the youth, one of the youth pastors that was in the talk afterwards asked me the question, because he's you know, engaging in this battle with his teens. And he asked the question, you know, how do we make arguments for the biblical view, God's view of homosexuality, and this could be any other topic too,
yeah,
with the generation that doesn't really abide by logic or reason or mm-hmm. critical thinking, but they're really driven by feelings. Even mm-hmm. gender, you know, gender distinctions are based on how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we talk to generations that really don't listen to logical, rational reasons, but, you know, go by their feelings?
Well, first I'd want to modify, or I'd want to challenge the assumption. There's no question in my mind that people are driven a lot by feelings, but that it's not an either-or proposition. It isn't as if the reasons don't matter. It's just the emotions that matter. I think the reasons do matter, and I've seen this play out over and over and over again. Certainly, emotions are given free rein and emotions rule. That is, many times emotions will, or the affective side, will trump reason. You know, I understand that.
Right.
And so we do need to be sensitive to that. But it doesn't mean we abandon reason and just appeal to emotion, because then we're adopting, we are championing a way of thinking or a way of moving forward that's not sound and not healthy. The way I put it is that emotions make life delicious, but careful thinking makes life safe. And
right.
So we don't want to just, in a sense, give in to that side. Well, they're all into emotion, so let's just use an emotional appeal, because then they'll be victimized by the next emotional appeal that comes along that just promises something more emotionally satisfying than what we promise. So, but I do think there's a way to blend the two. For the one, I think truth has got to be the issue. Truth has got to. Here is what matters. What matters is what's true. And when it comes to, say, the homosexuality issue, I understand that there are a lot of people who self-identify as Christians who are more who are moved on the homosexuality issue because they have friends that are gay. And consequently, this is what it comes down to. And this comes from Alan Schliemann, this thought, not from me, but I think it's a good one. They care more about being faithful to their friends than they do to be faithful to Christ.
Right.
And so, yes, now they are moved by their feeling. But see, now that's a different problem, isn't it? Now we're not talking about the issue of homosexuality. We're talking about the issue of fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
And see, now this is where I'm going to want to step in and say, wait a minute. And I find I'm doing this a lot lately. Where do your loyalties lie? When you say you're a follower of Christ, or when you're a Christian, what does that mean? Now, I'm not trying to be to shame them or to be abusive in any way. I'm trying to, in a certain sense, speak clearly and lay it on the line. Okay, I understand you got friends, right? Okay, are your friends' approval more important to you than Christ's approval? That's
right.
The question you, young man, young woman, have to answer for yourself. I can't answer that. But I want you
right.
to see what is hanging in the balance. You can choose life or you can choose death. That's what's in the balance here. And so there's a certain sense in which I think we need to, as disciplers and as mentors, to communicate the gravity of the circumstances that we're in. And here I don't mean the gravity of homosexuality. I mean the gravity of lack of faithfulness. Fear of man brings a snare. That's Proverbs. Friendship with the world is hostility towards God. That's James. So we can press some of these verses into service here to help people to see what's actually at stake here. Now, some people, frankly, are just going to say, you know what? I love my friends. I can't tell my friends they're wrong. And I can't, and whether you tell your friends they're wrong or not is a tactical concern, actually. But if you're siding with their friends, if they're siding on this issue with their friends, that's different. That shows where their own convictions are at. So I think this is not an easy issue to deal with. I think this is challenging. I admit that entirely. And it's going to get more challenging, not less challenging, as time goes on. You are doing a noble thing, investing in your children the ability to think carefully about these issues and to see the foolishness when it comes along. Now, when people have the ability to see the empty, vacuous appeals that a person like Matthew Vines and the Reformation Project are making, those who claim to be Christian and also claim to do champion homosexuality, saying that we just got the text wrong, we've misunderstood for thousands of years, and I mean that literally thousands of years, all the way back to Genesis with Sodom and Gomorrah, we've just got it wrong. And the new breed has it right. And Alan Schliemann and I are writing on that now. In fact, the first edition of our treatment of the Matthew Vines approach is already out beginning of this month and beginning of September. I'm actually working on it this week, finalizing Alan's draft, because we co-wrote this. And that'll be out in September, I believe, September 1st. And so there's our 1-2 punch dealing with that. But once we need to be able to address those issues, if we can teach them how to think carefully, they won't be taken in by sophistry so easily. And if we can show them what the scripture actually says, then what becomes clear is that this is an issue of who you're going to follow, whether you're going to follow your friends and deem acceptance by them more important than following Christ and valuing acceptance by Christ. For myself, and I'm telling you, for me personally, and what I want to instill in my daughters and in others that I influence, I want to hear at the end of the game, I want to hear those words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." That's what I want to hear. And so I think as regarding young people, this is the message that we need to be communicating to them. That's what we want. This is what we value. And so if the young people are eating pizza and playing games and doing all that stuff, well, there might be a place for that. But if they're getting that and they're missing this other thing, they're not being discipled and mentored into disciplined followers of Christ, serious, who kind of see what's going on, then of course they're going to side with their friends. We shouldn't be surprised. So I think that it's not the case that kids, young people, don't care about reason anymore. But I do understand that many times, because they are not, because of the nature of their commitment, they are swayed by other things, and sometimes will go the wrong direction because of their feelings about their friends or something like that, or they don't want to get called names or whatever. Now, this is an opportunity for discipleship, in my view, at least.
Right. So the tactic would be, bring it back to the central question, what does God think about this, and where are your loyalties?
Those would be the two questions, exactly. Exactly. Right. Because Matthew Vines challenge is that God thinks this is okay, and so this is just a matter of more careful exegesis. So this is a factual problem about the meaning of the text, and it's always good that kids learn more about how to parse that out. My brother in Florida is starting a group, like a small men's group or discussion group, and he's focusing on this issue. And he told me today, I was talking to him on the way into the studio, he said, you know, this not only helps us educate us on this issue, and he's using Kevin DeYoung's book as a launching pad for this discussion about homosexuality. But since these issues are coming up with the culture, it helps us to know how to deal with the culture. It helps us to do apologetics, and it helps us to think carefully about Scripture, because you got to do careful exegesis now to get the right answer. So that's one thing that will go. That's the factual issue of what Scripture says. But then, okay, given what Scripture says, are we going to be faithful to God given that and the challenge from the world? That's a second issue. So both of those are real critical. That's what I'd focus in on.
Perfect.
All right.
Makes sense.
Terry, good talking to you.
Thanks, Greg.
I appreciate your call. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back with more questions on Stand to Reason.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, your church, or your youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California. In October, we'll be in Dallas, Texas, and we'll equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, Instagram, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org. Click Get Connected at the top of the page.
Show us Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel here giving you a piece of my mind, as I do every week from 4 until... See, now I'm not sure what to say. I used to say 4 until 7, but sometimes we're doing two-hour shows. So 4 until sometime, 2 to 3 hours of clear-thinking Christianity for your benefit. If you'd like to call in the future, just call in during the live show Tuesday nights 4 until 7 and or 4 to 6 for sure. And we'd be glad to take your calls. Let's go to Maine and talk with Tim. Hello, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you for the service you provide for the kingdom. I've listened to many, many, many hours of your teaching while I've been gardening and doing my job.
Uh-huh. So. Well, good. You have a garden there in Maine?
Well, I work for some people who have an estate, and I'm their guy.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, you got a short growing season there, I'm afraid.
This year was sadly short,
uh-huh.
But plenty of exercise, shoveling. That's a good side of it.
All right, what's on your mind there, Tim?
Well, we've been having a lot of discussions recently in my church on this Calvinism idea, and in the past, if I was to be on a slide where Calvinism is on one side and Arminianism is on the other, I would have been like almost in between. But mm-hmm. as I get more teaching in, listening to different people like R.C. Sproul and people like that, you know, I'm way over to Calvinism. And, you know, and I kind of say that so you don't think this is some kind of a gotcha question.
Right.
What makes me think of my question here is in Romans chapter 1 in verse 20, where it says that, you know, talking about how the power of God is plainly seen, you know, at the end of that verse it says, so that men are without excuse. And I got thinking, wouldn't it be if someone died, you know, apart from the Lord and stood in judgment, wouldn't they have the best excuse ever by just simply saying, wait a minute, unfair, you didn't choose me. I had absolutely no choice in this whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a couple of ways to respond to that. First of all, and I'm just thinking back now on a parable of Jesus, the unfair challenge never works with God. And the reason is God has absolutely no obligation to distribute his grace evenly among everyone. Grace is something that is unearned and undeserved. And the parable I'm thinking of is when Jesus talked about the people who were workers in the field and or in the courtyard, and they got hired at different stages of the day, but each got paid the same thing. And the person who worked the longer was complaining that the person who worked the least got paid the same. And he said, look, I'm a gracious man. The response to him was, are you angry because I'm gracious? I gave you what I agreed with you to give. And so you got treated justly, appropriately in terms of our agreement. If I'm generous with somebody else, what is that to you? Can't I be generous with my own things? Okay. So that's part of the answer. The issue of fairness is not a legitimate issue when it comes to these kinds of concerns, because it implies that God has a moral obligation to distribute all of his unmerited favor equally. And right in that sentence, there is a contradiction. If it is unmerited, then there's no obligation. Okay? God will have grace upon whom he has grace. And this, by the way, is a New Testament concept from top to bottom.
Okay. Well, could we scratch the unfair comment then?
Sure. Okay.
And,
yeah.
And then the guy said, "Well, there was nothing I could do."
This, correct.
You didn't choose me.
Here's another principle.
And I truly believe, you know, that what you're saying about that, the unfairness thing. I think that's right. I mean, Paul, isn't it? Paul, he doesn't even seem to offer up a defense. He just says, "Who are you, old man?"
Yes, that's in Romans 9. Yeah, he does. Right. And that, I think he's right about that.
Yeah.
You know, God can do what he wants with that which is his, and forgiveness is his and his alone. Now, if he condemns the guiltless, that's a problem. But if he condemns the guilty, they get what they earned. Okay? And whether they had a choice or not is irrelevant to the question. And so now I want to get back to your more pressing concern here. It is not a legitimate complaint for a person who is a sinner to say, "I shouldn't be punished because you did not rescue me from myself." Let me just say that again, because I don't want people to miss this. The person who is a sinner, a rebel in God's kingdom, cannot justly complain about judgment against him by saying, "God, you did not rescue me from myself, and therefore you're not justified in punishing me." Now, look, God has no obligation to rescue anybody from themselves. All of us are going down the wrong road. All of us are guilty. Now, from a Reformed perspective, a Calvinist perspective, God can give his grace to whoever he wants. And if he gives his grace that is not deserved to some and not to others, that's up to him. That's the whole notion of grace, unmerited favor. And therefore, it is not legitimate for the other person to say, "Well, you know, you didn't choose me, so it's not my fault, it's your fault." No, God is holding them responsible for their rebellion, which is thoroughgoing and is from the womb. And I realize that raises some other concerns, but the fact is every single person has rebelled from the beginning against God and is thoroughly guilty. What's interesting about the Romans 1 and 2 passages is the whole reason that Paul is laying this out at the beginning of Romans is to show that everyone is fallen and in rebellion against God, and therefore no one is in any circumstance where they can give an excuse, which is why he repeats the phrase, "and there is no excuse," or "they are without excuse," at least two times in this section, so that they are without excuse. The thrust of this passage is to demonstrate that no one can properly offer an excuse to God, whether it's "I didn't know," "I did the best I could," "I followed my own ethic," or whatever, you know. All of the bases are covered there in Romans 1 and 2. And so I think the simple answer is the person cannot justifiably complain, "The reason I'm going to hell is because you didn't rescue me." No, the reason that people go to hell is right there in Revelation 20. As God is doing his act of justice, he has opened the books and he is comparing their life, he is looking at their behaviors, and he is judging human beings according to their deeds. Every person so judged in the book of Revelation is judged according to their deeds, and everyone is found wanting. And this is why there is no hope without Jesus, which is the point of the book of Romans. So I'm just not compelled by that, you know. It's almost like, "Gee, you know, I didn't ask to be born," kind of teenager complaint about life, you know.
Well, you've made that's actually, you know, you made some good points. A while ago, you were talking about, I think it was might have even been that the total depravity idea. And you brought up the idea of in the Lord of the Rings, I think they're called the Uruk-hai.
Uruk-hai, yeah. I did talk about the...
Born out of the ground, and you brought up this, you know, they deserve to die as soon as they come out of the ground.
Right, right. They were born evil. Yes.
Yeah, and I guess what I was looking for is this, maybe even some kind of a sliver of a idea that maybe there's some place where we say, okay, I choose. But mm-hmm. And certainly I'm a strong believer that we can't come to Christ except that mm-hmm. you know, the Father draws us.
That's right, yeah.
And I see in the book of Acts these very interesting places where it says, and those who were appointed or those who were elected
right.
believe that day.
Right,
but
right.
I was just kind of looking for any kind of a way.
Yeah, well, in the Reformed view, people do choose, but they choose in virtue of God's choice for them.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't overcome their will. He woos them in and wins them over. And by the kind intention of his own will, he chooses them, and then he woos them in. And he does that in a powerful way. So he doesn't contravene their will. What he does is he reinclines their will towards him, so that then they respond to him. I like to think of somebody who falls in love with someone else. They end up wanting that person. Their will has been inclined through in a sense, the magic of love to want and desire that other person, and so they freely choose them to marry. But they only freely choose them to marry because their will has been influenced by love. So that's something you could experiment with here. Got to run, Tim. Thanks so much for the call. I got to get to Nick here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania with an update. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Greg.
Hey.
How are you?
Okay. You got a follow-up, huh?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, sorry. I'm good. I'm trying to get to a quiet spot.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if you remember me calling you, it's probably been about 7-8 months now.
Okay.
About some apologetics resources for junior hires, and you kind of, how do I say it? You weren't too happy for me to ask that question. You said something about junior hires not being your favorite age group, but you did.
I was glad you asked the question. I just did have a lot to offer, probably.
Right. But no, you did tell me that a good way to go would be some fallacies, stuff like that, and that's what we did.
And, like the Fallacy Detective book that the earlier caller talked about, maybe.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. We talked about the law of non-contradiction, and then 5 other fallacies,
mm-hmm.
and 63 kids, 12 to 15, and you know they ate it up. They had a great time with it. They really learned a lot, and they were even, you know, I was seeing if I could stump them throughout the week, and they called me out every time.
Oh my goodness, good for you, 63.
Yes.
You know, I consistently get this kind of report that young people like this. My 10-year-old loves it. She already had her fallacy stuff last year, but the enforcer here, Melinda Penner, was a middle school teacher for a number of years, and she had no trouble finding an interest in middle schoolers for this kind of thing.
Yeah, it was really encouraging. So I think we're going to introduce some new ones next year.
Good.
Yeah. So I do have a question,
mm-hmm.
and The question, what it was one of the questions that was asked during my week of camp, and they asked, you know, what's with the ages in the beginning of Genesis?
Uh-huh.
And I got to tell you, I did a little bit of research, and everything was way too long for the amount of time I had to do some research.
Right.
So I was wondering if you could just give me a quick.
Well, you know, it's always
It's
always legitimate to say I just don't know about that. You know,
sure.
I mean, some things because these. Some of these things are complex. They're ambiguous. It's not always entirely clear what the right answer is, and they have little consequence. And
true.
So when you have a combination of things like that, you've got to triage because of time limitations. Sometimes you just give it the brush off. So not that mm-hmm. you're just dismissing kids' questions, but you know, you're choosing which questions you're going to take the time to answer.
Right.
There is... I'm not certain about that, okay? There is a possibility, and for me to say this is going to be anathema to some people, but I'm just suggesting it as a possibility. There's a possibility that some of these things are hyperbole, which is exaggeration for the sake of effect. I don't know that. Somebody has suggested that. I don't have any problem with them being real ages, that why people lived that long back then. I've heard a couple of different scientific kind of explanations. Well, back then there weren't so many mutagens around, and you know, our genes weren't all screwed up from generation after generation of this, that, and the other thing. And that made sense to me. I don't know. I certainly think it's possible that that's the case, but that there may be other options. So, I mean, this is one of the times where I'm saying, gee, I don't really have a lot to say about this one, you know.
Okay.
But it's not that important in the long run. And it's possible that these are exaggerations, but maybe not, and maybe probably not, but not entirely sure why. I would go to a place like Reasons to Believe.
Okay.
I'm sure they've got something on this that would help. You know, some people like Answers in Genesis. I'm sure they've talked on that, too. These are two different perspectives, two different ways of approaching these kinds of problems, those two organizations. One is Old Earth and one is Young Earth. But just so you know, but this particular detail, I don't think trades on a commitment to the age of the universe at all. Whether the genealogies are complete or not, that's another question, and that does influence that discussion. But as to the ages themselves, I think there's a couple of things that might be in view there. So I would go to the specialists on that and figure out what they have to say, and then take it from there.
Okay.
All right.
Well, great.
And I'm glad you reported back in. I occasionally will say that to somebody. In fact, I think last week I gave some advice and said, get back to me about the circumstance. I want to see how it turned out. And I'm always glad to hear from the field, as it were, how this stuff has worked out. And this reinforces, by the way, for me, and this came up in an earlier call, that some people think that young people don't care about reason.
And they do. Oh, they really do.
Yeah.
And
what's great about the way you probably approached it and the way that book helps them handle it, it's almost like sport to them, and so they can get into it and have a lot of fun with it. Is that right?
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate Nick, you following up on that and getting back to me. Keep up the good work and keep training those kids. Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Take care now.
All right, Greg.
All right.
See ya.
Bye. That book was The Fallacy Detective, and there is also another book by the same author that is called Something Toolbook. Now I can't think of it. Somebody just mentioned it. But find The Fallacy Detective. You'll find the other one real easily. I don't know if we carry that at Stand to Reason or not. But go to Amazon. That's where I usually go for these kinds of things. And use Amazon Smile and have Stand to Reason be your recipient of rewards. We'd appreciate that. Okay, that's it for our hour, friends. You're listening to Stand to Reason. And I'm Greg Kokel.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.